Hello, it's Jill Burridge here, and today I'm welcoming back Dr. Murray Freeman, who joined us earlier in the year. When we were talking, we chatted about a particular book that you had just finished reading. You use audiobooks, don't you?
This particular one I got because I belong to the Library Book Club in Harpenden, and all the rest of the group, they're sighted. I'm the only one who has to use an audio version. So they found me an audio version, and I read along with them.
And this book is called Life After Life. It's written by Kate Atkinson, who many people will know. I think her first book was Behind the Scenes at the Museum, and she's written detective novels since, Case Histories, which have actually been televised.
Yes, my first knowledge of her.
Yes, right. But this is completely different, isn't it?
It's the most different book I've ever read. And when you asked me to do this book review, it meant I had to read it again. Since when I have become utterly obsessed with the book. I enjoyed it very much the first time I read it. And it was a great shock to me when I went to the book club meeting to find that I was tremendously enthusiastic about it. And everybody else said, oh, didn't understand it. It was a weird book. Kept jumping about. And to me, that was the sort of nub of it, really. So the more I've thought about it and the more I've read and reread it, quite honestly, the more I've got out of it.
It is very different. Should we give a brief sort of outline of how the plot works? It is a family saga, essentially, isn't it?
Yes, it's the story of Ursula Todd, the middle child of a family of five, of a couple who live in Beaconsfield, not that far away, but very sort of Enid Blyton background country. And they have a lovely garden which backs onto the woods, and the children play in the woods. And there's a sort of Lord of the Manor house up the road where a couple live with their children. And there are nice neighbours with three boys and various children.
Ursula Todd is born in 1910.
Yes, that's the one certainty about this book. Nothing else is certain, not even when she dies. The book starts in a strange way, and when you just hear the first sort of introductory bit, and then it sort of starts, as I say, with her birth in 1910, you wonder what the first bit was all about. So I won't tell you until later on, because that's part of the story.
What if some day or night a demon were to steal after you into your loneliest loneliness and say to you, this life as you now live it and have lived it, you will have to live once more and innumerable times more. Would you not throw yourself down and gnash your teeth and curse the demon who spoke thus? Or have you once experienced a tremendous moment when you would have answered him, you are a god and never have I heard anything more divine?
At its sort of simplest level, it's a book about middle-class England and a middle-class family, and how they lived through the pre-war, pre-1918 war. She's born, as you say, in February 1910, and they go through the First World War, then the interwar years, and then she lives through the Second World War and the Blitz. And that all sounds tremendously straightforward, but really it's nothing to do with the book, I don't think.
Because I agree with you there. I think we're going to disagree later on, so I'll say I agree.
Well, the introduction to the book in the sort of version that you get says, what would it be like if you had to live your life over and over again until you got it right? Now, she doesn't live it over and over again until she gets it right, but she does live it over and over again. And the first time I read it, it really struck a chord with me because I thought, life is so chancy. You know, you're walking along a road and you step one way and something happens, you step another way and something totally different happens. And it's this chance of what sort of life you actually have that fascinated me. And that's what it's all about, because as you read the book, well, every chapter starts with the date, and you've got to listen to that because otherwise you'll wonder where you are. And this is what most of the people who read it didn't like, because at one minute you can be in 1910 and her birth, and the next minute you find you're in 1925. And then it goes back to 1910 again. And you think, well, what on earth is she playing at? And I did for a long while, and I keep listening to it again and again and keep finding that there's different things in it. In a way, it's a device for telling the story of all the important events that happened during that period, but in the life of one girl. Now, obviously, one young girl doesn't live all those lives. Mm. You couldn't possibly write a novel about a girl who had all those different experiences. But by chopping it up in this way and jumping backwards and forwards, Kate Atkinson could introduce a lot of important events over this period of the First World War, the interwar and the Second World War into this one girl's life. And I think that's really the clever device that Kate Atkinson has used. And I may be wrong, she may tell me something different. But to me, that is it. Now, how it goes through when you're reading the book, well, in a funny way, not being able to see and using a talking book version is quite useful, because anybody who reads talking books usually does it at night in bed. They switch it on and then they put a time stop so that if they fall asleep before the end, they haven't got too far back to go. With this, you don't know where you are, quite frankly, because as I say, one chapter you're in 1910, the next you're in 1923, and then you're back in 1910 again. So wherever you stop, you might as well carry on and go back to the beginning again. And it's a very good read for all these different parts of the story. There's wonderful sequences of the sort of pre-war years of looking at a middle-class family living in Beaconsfield and the things they do. They've got a nursemaid, well, a maid, and a cook, and the lives they lead, and the father's in banking. The one sort of standout character for me is the aunt, the father's sister, Izzy, who's really a bit of a she's the ultimate naughty aunt in a family. And a lot of things happen because of Izzy, or Izzy helps out with a lot of things. So let's go back a bit to the beginning. It starts, as I say, with a chapter that I won't tell you about till later on.
But can I just interrupt you to give people just the idea that why it keeps going back is because she has this device, Kate Atkinson uses a device, that her character, Ursula Todd, dies several times throughout the book.
Well, she doesn't so much die as things come to an end.
Well, I took it as death, but anyway.
Well,
we'll have to agree to disagree on this, Murray.
Because blackness comes over her at different points.
They are life-threatening incidences.
Exactly.
Oh,
but you don't literally know she's dead.
You don't, no.
They are life-threatening.
That's why you go back to the beginning.
And blackness comes over her, and snow. Very often it says snow, and you know that snow is the end. But she's actually born in snow, or born at a time of snow in February. And her mother is, you think, on her own in the house. She goes into an early labour. Father's gone off looking for this wayward sister of his on the continent, who's run off with some ne'er-do-well and gets pregnant. But Sylvia, her mother, is on her own and goes into labour.
Dr. Fellow should have been here, Sylvie moaned. Why isn't he here yet? Where is he? Big dewdrop pearls of sweat on her skin, a horse nearing the end of a hard race, the bedroom fire stoked like a ship's furnace, the thick brocade curtains drawn tightly against the enemy, the night, the black bat.
And she calls for the little 14-year-old maid to come and help, because it's thick snow outside and the doctor can't get to her. So she delivers the baby on her own with the help of the nursemaid, or the maid. She's a kitchen maid, not a nursemaid, kitchen maid. And the baby is born, Ursula is born, with the cord round her neck, utterly blue and lifeless. So you think that's the end of the story?
Well, it can't be. It's right at the beginning of the book.
Exactly. So later in the book, you get another version of this where she finds a pair of scissors in the bedside table and she cuts the cord and the baby survives. And she's quite a bonny bouncing baby. There is another episode where later in the book, where it's all again 1910, she's delivered the baby, but the doctor has actually got there and he delivers the baby and cuts the cord. So there are several different versions of this one event of death when she might or might not have died. And that really epitomises the rest of the book, because there's several different events where she might or might not have died, and you pick the story up in another chapter, not necessarily sequential, but later, and you find a totally different variant of the story.
You see, that's, I found it frustrating, I have to say, because I'd just got into the scenario and I was, you know, beginning to gather pace and momentum, and I'd engaged with the characters, and then all of a sudden,
whoop, we're back at the beginning again.
Yes, and I thought, oh, this is a bit of a cop-out in terms of the writer, because she's created this situation, and it's almost as if she can't get herself out of it. She doesn't know which way to write the next direction. Yes. So she just absolutely...
That's why I would say this is a Marmite book. You either love it or hate it.
I've met a lot
of people who hate it, but I love it because it really has made me think about all sorts of, you wouldn't believe it, all sorts of everyday events that occur.
What has it made you particularly think? Can you think of an example?
you'll find this very weird. Programme this morning about, the monkey cage with...
Oh, yes, the science programme on Radio 4.
Yes, because...
They were doing relativity.
Yes, and quantum theory.
Yes.
Now, quantum theory is totally compatible with this story, this way of writing a story.
Really?
Yes, because they don't believe in a universe, they believe in a multiverse. And all these different events that you've heard in the book that get to a different point and then something else wafts in... That is a multiverse where we might be slipping, sliding between different versions of our own lives.
Professor Brian Cox might enjoy this book then.
So when you ask what's it made me think, I've gone into all sorts of realms I hadn't thought of. One of the others, just to sort of speed it on a bit, is we get the 1914-18 war and there's things like the Spanish flu when there was the big epidemic and people died. And Bridget, the little maid, is going off with one of the soldiers who comes back from the war who's injured, and they're going to celebrate peace in London. But, you see, Ursula does get forebodings of things. She gets feelings of déjà vu, that she's been there before. It's not that she dies and it's nothing to do with her. She does seem somehow to have a premonition, and she has this premonition that she doesn't want the maid to go up to London. And so she pushes her downstairs, which seems a bit drastic. And that results in her being sent to a psychiatrist, which is another whole strand. I mean, there's so much in this book. Really, it's very hard to talk about it in any sort of sequential way because there's nothing sequential about it at all. Another example, her brother Morris is a bit of a monster. He's the eldest boy in the family and none of them really like him. And he ends up being a pretty unlikable character in the Admiralty in the war. So there's a sequence of the other characters, funnily, the family are in sequence, but she jumps backwards and forwards into these different lives. Well, let's think of another one. She doesn't let the maid go up to the end of the war in 1918, but the young man does, and he dies of Spanish flu, but the maid comes back, and Ursula gets this sort of great feeling of relief that she stopped that happening. So there's a feeling that she has some control over these other lives, which doesn't totally make sense.
No, but she doesn't have control of events that happen to her in later life.
No, well, not at all. I mean, not right from the very beginning. She doesn't have any control over anything.
So the other scenarios are the consequence of things that happen to her, actually, that she doesn't have any control over. Or I was thinking of later in life when she was in her teens and Morris's friend comes on to her.
Yes. I mean, to put no finer point on it, she gets raped on the back stairs. But at the same time, she doesn't get raped on the back stairs because there's another whole part of her life where that hasn't happened.
We mustn't give too much away. But you see, I thought that Kate Atkinson, as the writer, became obsessed with this device that she'd created. That's what infuriated me, I have to say, throughout the book.
Isn't it funny how the same thing can stimulate totally different feelings? Because to me, that was, okay, well, that's something that happened, but it might not have happened. And so it didn't happen. So she goes sailing through the birthday party without it happening.
I can see where you're coming from.
So she ends up
streams of
at the end of her life thinking she's never had a child. Whereas, of course, after the rape, she does become pregnant.
But you don't know where you are by the end of
no,
the book.
No, because...
You don't know what's
end
reality.
Of the book, no, that's perfectly true. That's why I say I know when she was born, but I don't know when she died, because there are so many different endings to the story as well. And one of the people I was with in the book club said she thought the weakest bit was that Ursula goes to Germany. She studies languages and is going to go to France and do a sort of little mini European tour. But instead she goes to Germany. And this strange part arises in the middle of the book, where she meets German friends and stays with them. But one of the people she meets is Eva Braun, Hitler's lady friend. And so she becomes a friend of Hitler. And you think, well, is that really feasible?
I suppose Diana Moseley did, didn't she?
Yes. And she has a potential impact on Hitler's life, which is the very beginning of the book, which you think when you read it at the beginning, it's this odd chapter at the beginning where she goes into a restaurant where Hitler's with his friends and she takes out her father's gun.
She dabbed politely at the streusel flakes on her lips and then bent down again to put the handkerchief back in her bag and retrieve the weighty object nesting there. Her father's old service revolver from the Great War, a Webley Mark V. A move rehearsed 100 times. One shot. Swiftness was all, yet there was a moment, a bubble suspended in time after she had drawn the gun and levelled it at his heart when everything seemed to stop.
Well, we know she didn't kill him because he went on to do the most hideous things.
Don't tell us what the rest of the book is.
No, I won't tell you. But again, where it sort of coincides with things that happen along my life, I was listening to a programme the other morning and Michael McPurgo was talking about his new book. And one of the stories he told is about his new book. And that is about a man who was a very sort of quiet, modest man, but in the First World War won all sorts of medals for bravery. And towards the end of the war, when the British are obviously winning the war and the Germans are retreating and the British group are firing on the Germans, and he sees this German staggering towards them, obviously shell-shocked and in a daze, and he says to his troops, "Don't fire, don't fire," and he goes up to the German and sort of turns him round and sends him back. And that apparently was Hitler. And, you know, that's the sort of thing that really blows your mind.
Mm, it does, it does.
And that's his new book, which I want to read because it sounds fascinating, that apparently Hitler himself knew all about it and had a picture of the man in his room. Mm, now, that's not the only time. There were several people who made attempts on Hitler's life, and for one reason or another, it didn't work. But just supposing one of those had worked, what would the world be like now? It's a tempting thought, isn't it?
It is, it is. Now, this book was published in 2013 and was shortlisted for the Booker, but yes. I think you've picked up on the fact that there's a sequel.
Well, first of all, let me just say a little bit about Kate Atkinson that might be of interest to our readers, is that her father went blind when he was only in his 40s, which I didn't appreciate. So she's got quite a sort of sympathy for those of us who struggle. And her father had two guide dogs for the blind. First one was a Labrador who was so greedy that it would drag you into the road in order to snuffle in the dustbins, and was sort of retired. And then he had a German Shepherd. But I thought this was interesting, that it may have nothing to do with the book, but just interesting that she does have an understanding of blindness and what it can do to people. Well, one of the important characters in the book is her not youngest, but her next to youngest brother, Teddy, who's very much the adored brother in the family. And he becomes a pilot in the war, the Second World War part. And he is shot down over Berlin. And you don't know until very near the end. Well, she is told firmly that he was killed because friends saw his plane going down and there was no way he could survive. But there is a nice bit at the end. And the new book she's written is Edward's story. It's the story from his point of view. So I think that will be interesting to see how she's written it about another member of the family and what comes out of that. So I'm looking forward to that. And maybe it'll win the prize, but perhaps not, because, as I say, it's a bit of a Marmite story.
We'll see. Well, you loved it.
Oh, I did.
Was a bit more dubious. But it was Life After Life, Kate Atkinson, and it is available as an audio book. And yes. Dr. Murray Freeman, thank you very much indeed for joining us again.
I hope I haven't made it even more muddling for everybody.
The music accompanying this edition of the Talking Bookshelf is called Good Times. It was composed and recorded by Goffby of Kenilworth, who's very generously given us permission to use his music.